The next case on our calendar is 07-1832, John and June Roe versus Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio. Justice O'Connor has recused herself in this case. We're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice O'Connor is Mary Donovan, who is a judge of the Second District Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge Donovan. Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The case before the court today is about protecting children from abuse. The plaintiffs have alleged that the defendant has engaged in a systematic effort to avoid their requirement to report known and suspected child abuse to the state, along with other allegations of failure to make proper reports to the parents. At this stage of the case, this is a discovery case. It's unusual for a case to be presented to the court in this posture, but that's where we are. We're in the process of collecting evidence, and it was a basic discovery ruling that was made by the trial judge. The trial court applied this court's test in Biddle, and if this court meant what was said in Biddle when it laid forth the roadmap of what a plaintiff needs to do to obtain third-party medical records, then the trial court got it right. It balanced our need for the information against the privacy interests are involved from the patients. We requested, pursuant to Biddle, that we receive medical records in a redacted form. The chalk that we're using here today is an example of one of those documents. And there's very limited information that we've requested for our case. We wanted to know the approximate age of the underage child. We wanted to know if they had specific histories when they came in of past sexually transmitted diseases or current sexually transmitted disease, and whether they're pregnant. And our experts are going to use that information, and it's part of our case because we are building a circumstantial case here that Planned Parenthood suspected child abuse. We have evidence that we'll present that will say that in the case of pregnancy, Planned Parenthood acknowledges that it's more likely than not that the minor had had sexual relations with an adult, and that there was a statutory rape that took place.
I'm having difficulty, Mr. Miller, in linking up your need for this kind of information about, I guess, any number of clients of the patients, whatever they're called, the Planned Parenthood, and the damages you seek in your case. Can you help me understand? I read the briefs, but I still am not clear on where's the linkage?
Your Honor, I think that there are a couple linkages here. First, under this court's recent decision in Craniac, we have to prove that they subjectively were aware and subjectively suspected child abuse. And what we want to use this information for is we want to say, listen, over the past 5 or 6 years, they have had 200 of these cases, and not in one case have they reported a suspected case of child abuse.
Well, how do you prove that from these redacted documents?
It's a statistical argument. In other words, if they're saying that it's more likely than not that in 50% of the cases or 60% of the cases that they should suspect child abuse and there's no report at all, and they've got 0% that they're reporting and 60% that they said that they're suspecting, then we're saying that that is just adding to the evidence and some of the other evidence that we're going to show. We don't think that this completely establishes our case, but it's an element of it.
But it doesn't give any answers, identification, or there's no subjective element to this, which you'd have to have, wouldn't you, to prove what you're trying to prove?
Well, again, we do need to prove a subjective element, and this is just one of the elements that we'll use. And we believe that this
Mr. Miller, what objective facts have to be known before one would have a subjective belief?
Well, one of the things, we believe that if you have these two facts together, to where there is an underage child let's take this case for example. You have an underage child, 14 years old, that presents, who is pregnant, who has a sexually transmitted disease that is brought in by a person who is not has a different name, who is merely 21 years old and pays for the procedure with their own personal credit card. We're saying in circumstances like that, that the medical provider should suspect what's going on. And you know, we have other evidence that we intend to present that shows that Planned Parenthood is actually participating in a systematic effort to avoid this reporting requirement because they don't believe in reporting statutory rapes.
Counsel, on page 4 of your brief, you set forth a long list of things that you have already established through discovery. This case comes down to the very narrow question of whether or not you're going up against privilege, right?
There is a privilege in place here, Your Honor, and we believe.
With respect to the other things, the statistical data, how many young women under the age of 18 have you performed abortions for, how many had sexually transmitted disease, all of that is obtainable through interrogatories and depositions of the principals involved with the defendant's operation.
We've requested the information in that form as well. We've requested raw data.
And that's not in dispute here, right? It's just whether or not you get to look at these forms.
No, Your Honor. They're actually disputing our ability to collect raw data. They have data that they report to the Ohio Department of Health.
I thought I read in your brief that the only thing they appealed was the issue of this form. Or getting the raw data, the privileged data.
That is an argument that we are presenting, is that they did not properly perfect that appeal, but they have not presented us with the raw data under the same arguments that we're not entitled to it because that information.
Well, what are we being asked to decide? Is our focus limited to whether or not you get the privileged data, or do we have to answer the question as to other statistical information that's not privileged?
Your Honor, we believe that we're entitled to three things. We believe that we're entitled to redacted medical reports, we believe we're entitled to the redacted abuse reports, and we believe that we're entitled to the raw data, and that's what we're asking this court to hold.
Are you suggesting you're entitled to those documents on all three of your statutory claims or just one?
We're saying that the medical records and the raw data would be entitled to on all claims. And not just the statutory claims, also the intentional infliction of emotional distress. The abuse reports would be primarily focused on the failure to report abuse and also the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. Because again, it's the same basis that the intentional failure to report, the systematic failure to report, is a means by which they're inflicting emotional distress upon the child because they're subjecting the child to continue abuse for longer duration than what is necessary.
This all goes to the measure of damages, right?
Well, it goes to damages. We believe it goes to intent. We believe that it goes to rule of evidence 404 requirements as far as their motivation, their opportunity
And what precisely, going back to the question that the chief asked you right at the beginning of this, what precisely, information-wise, is that pertains to your case, that's relevant to your case, would you obtain from looking at the privileged files of individual young women that you would not have available to you from answers to interrogatories and depositions regarding the statistical data?
Your Honor, if they provide the accurate information.
So you think they're cheating? That's what this is all about.
I'm not saying that they're cheating, Your Honor. What I'm saying is this court has held that we're not required to rely upon the testimony that is provided by the other party. And moreover, we believe that by redacting the information, the identity information, we are protecting the privilege. It's very limited information that we're looking for here. You know, date of birth, age, whether that there's been a disease, and whether there's a pregnancy. We're not interested in knowing the identity of the patients. We have no desire to contact them, and we believe.
And this is for all young women who obtained an abortion, is that correct?
all young women who have reported to the facility, they don't necessarily have to have had an abortion. I mean, this is not an abortion.
So you want it for those who weren't even pregnant?
Who were pregnant, who reported that they reported they were pregnant, reported the STD. We understand that that's about 200 records a year. And so it's not necessarily a huge voluminous number.
Counsel, this wasn't in your brief. It was in the brief of the congressmen and congresswomen. They asserted that children have a diminished informational privilege. And that's counterintuitive to me. Could you explain that? Is that part of your argument, or
Your Honor, the aspect of the argument is that to obtain informed consent from the child, because they're a child, they do not have the ability to consent.
Right,
you have
I understand that, but that brief seems to take it over and say, well, they don't have the same privilege with respect to what would otherwise be privileged documents.
We're not here to argue that if something is privileged, it's not privileged because it's a child. I mean, that may apply for the parents, but that we're not making that argument. But what we're concerned about is the creation of a public policy exception here that is trying to protect a class of records, or a class of patients because they're abortion of patients or something along those lines. Because in other contexts, following Biddle, the courts throughout this state have allowed the production of third-party medical records. In fact, the United States Supreme Court, Justice Brennan, in an opinion he wrote as a circuit justice, specifically stated that in an abortion case, it was appropriate for the discovery of redacted third-party medical records. We're not asking this court to hold anything other than what Justice Brennan held. And Justice Brennan's opinion in that case has been followed by courts across the country, and has been followed by the district courts here in Ohio, and so we're simply asking this court to fall in line with those decisions. And it's from Arizona. We cite them in our brief. Connecticut, Rhode Island. We believe that is essentially the same test that this court has established in Biddle.
I believe the lower court indicated you didn't need these documents to prove your claims. How would you suggest we define need?
Well,
or has it already been defined by this court?
Need has been defined by this court in the discovery context. Need is not an absolute, you must have it or your case is it goes away. I mean, this is a discovery we're talking about. Need is basically information that is helpful in establishing your case, and it is not available from any other source. Those are the standards that the courts apply for need, not just in the context of discovery from a party in the case, but also if you're sending a subpoena out to someone.
Well, counsel, there are important competing interests at play here. That is the open, free, full, honest discovery, balanced up against a venerable, time-honored, not just statutorily, but in common law, privilege. And don't you have to, doesn't need become a heightened hurdle when you're bumping into the privilege of medical records?
Your Honor, the need is the need, and we believe that it's important because of Kroniak that our need is that the only two ways that we're going to establish that they were subjectively aware that abuse is occurring is either if A, they admit it, or two, we build it in a circumstantial case.
But
we need information to build a circumstantial case. So that's our need. And the protected information is protected simply by redaction. That is what, that's how it's protected. It's the identity of the patient that must be protected, and that's protected.
Mr. Miller, though, we're not talking about a class action here. We're talking about a single situation. And under the statutes, you potentially may get punitive damages for a single violation. Isn't that correct?
I'm
concerned about, again, the issue of overriding the privilege to medical records of third parties when really, if you focus on the situation at hand with informed consent, parental consent, and you prove your case there, you already have the ability to get the remedy you seek.
Well, we would be able to get a punitive damages for those claims. Now, we would not be able, that would not help us get punitive damages for the claim for failure to report the abuse. And also, you know, this information, I mean, when we establish and the jury understands that this is a systematic effort, that certainly goes to the amount of punitive damages. This court recently held in the Barnes case that was just released in July that the pattern and practice evidence like this goes to reprehensibility.
Well,
we
counsel,
have to be able to discover the information to be able to present the pattern and practice so that we can establish that that reprehensibility, which is the same argument that the counsel for Planned Parenthood won in the Southern District of Ohio in the Poneris case.
Counsel, in the front of your brief, though, you allege that you already have established through discovery that for the years 2000 through 2004, there were zero reports of suspected abuse by this agency.
We believe that the reports that we're seeking in this case will show that. They did produce the cases from 2000 to 2004, the reports, and there's nothing in there indicating that there's anything that's suspected. They're now trying to claw those back, and that's part of the reason that we're here, and we've requested those also ongoing. And they're refusing to produce the ongoing information. And, you know, for the full time period that we've requested based upon...
Ongoing, you mean you want to bring it up to the present?
We want to bring it up to the present. And we also requested 10 years. So they gave us you know, a six-year period. We wanted the other four, I guess.
You get occurrences after the fact in a...
if it was a, you know, part of an ongoing practice, if it's ongoing, we think that's important. But it was also, there was the four years on the front end of that. They did not provide us that information either.
Counsel, just a question as to what... all you're asking for. Are you asking for reports that were also made to the appropriate agency when there was suspected child abuse? Is that part of your request?
Yes, Your Honor. We're requesting those reports. And the reason we're requesting those reports is not to present them into evidence or to put them into the evidence. The point of those reports is that and those are the reports that we're just discussing. We believe that if we show that they have never reported a case of suspected abuse, that will help us establish our case that they're intentionally not reporting those. And we believe that we're entitled to those reports under the precedent of this court in State versus SR, where it said that there's no absolute bar to the discovery of the information. Also in the State Ex Rel Beacon Journal case, where this court stated that redacting the names of the reporter, and we think also the victim would be sufficient to protect the information that's there. The Johnson versus Johnson case held, which is from a court of appeals, held that there's an inherent power of the courts to order the production of information. That's been followed by a number of district courts throughout the state. It's been followed by the federal district courts in Ohio. The AG agrees. And you know, and beyond that, we also cited you to the regulatory authority on this, where the administrative rules state that the information can be shared by a court order. It can be shared when it's needed to protect a child victim, and it says
Could you help me understand? I understand the request for the data on those who were not reported to make your claim. I'm not sure I understand the need for the report of those that were reported, and unless you have some way to link those up, I'm not sure what it is that it what it would.
We're generally not allowed to ask, you know, the other side to do our work for us, and so we're just requesting the information so that we can then take that information and build our case. And so, you know, if we ask them. Yeah, to tell us every time that you've not reported, you know, give us every information of where you've not made this report, I think what they will say is, you know, that they will, they would argue that that they've made it in every case where they suspected it. They said, we've given you everything. We've always suspected it when we suspected it. And really, if you read their brief carefully, what they're saying is they suspect it when they know it. That's the argument that they make, that they only have a duty and they should only have a duty. And their amici make this argument also, that they should only have a duty when they know that there's an abuse, when they've been told that information.
To get that information or that knowledge, that link you're talking about, do you not have to be able to identify the actual report that was made with the forms, the general forms that you're asking for with the redacted information about age and that sort of thing? How else are you going to tell unless you match those up?
Well, the information would have to be tied together, and we believe that we could probably do that based upon the birth date information, the limited birth date information that we're requesting, and the service date. So we think that would be enough to tie the information together so that our experts can make the presentation. Again, we have to remember, we're at the discovery phase of the case here. So it's just we're asking to be able to seek this information. The trial court, the question that should have been answered by the Court of Appeals is whether the trial court abused its discretion in allowing us to have this information. The trial court then conducted a de novo review, not just of the discovery case and whether in the balancing test that occurs under Biddle, but they conducted a de novo review of our entitlement to everything under each of our statutory elements.
Because they believed it was a legal issue, isn't that the reason?
Well, the legal...
The appellee's argument that this is a legal issue.
There is a legal issue of the question of whether or not a privilege applies, be it medical or legal. And the answer to that question is yes, a privilege applies.
It's your position that the balancing of the countervailing interest should be done by the trial judge?
Correct, Your Honor. That balancing interest, once we've determined that there is a protective interest, then we have to give the trial court the discretion to conduct that balancing. Otherwise, these cases are going to be appealed. And
your authority for that proposition is generally discovery orders are reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard?
The factual elements of discovery, and when a court goes in and determines what to do and whether things are produced or not, that is generally reviewed as an abuse of discretion. So the legal question, are medical documents privileged? Are these medical documents? Yes. We agree with that. And we do not say that that's not a legal question. But then once you get into the balancing test, then that's something that is routinely in these discovery cases left within the sound discretion of the trial judge. And so
your time is up.
My time is up, Your Honor. And with that, I'll take my seat. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Buckley.
May I remove the Jane Rose chart?
Yes, you may.
Before you take it down, let me ask you one question. Where on this form does it disclose the age of the father?
It shows the age.
The father.
It doesn't. But what is this chart? Pages that aren't here, Your Honor.
Okay. Is that on the form someplace?
Yes. Okay. There. It's.
Go ahead and take it down then.
Why don't you tip it the other way so they're not blocking counsel from, you'd probably like to do that, but.
In a small county, first of all, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I apologize. In a small county in particular, it's the psychosocial history or the particular juxtaposition of medical conditions that may lead straight to the identity of a patient. For example, a basketball player is in a psychosocial history. This chart includes tax returns that show the names of the parents, for example. This chart shows any number of things that are not before the court today. It's Jane Roe's chart. What Jane Roe has and what the patients, the minors, who are not before the court have is really the first principle of your decision in Hageman in June of this year, and that is the right to direct disclosure of this most private medical information. Jane Roe presumably directed this disclosure. None of the others, not before the court, cannot have that. Particularly after Cranach, particularly after this court's decision in Cranach, the plaintiffs cannot show a cognizable need, let alone necessity, in these records. First, there is the allegation of...
Well, we've heard opposing counsel's definition, if you will, of need. What is your definition of need? Or what do you think is the appropriate definition of need?
It must bear some probative value on any point in issue. It must be useful to the disposition of the case. These records are not. Let me take the failure to report claim, for example. And by the way, Planned Parenthood categorically denies any systematic and intentional failure to report child abuse. After Cranach, the standard for failure to report is a subjective standard, Your Honor. The question is, what was in the mind of the reporter? What Dr. K knew or didn't know? What the patient said to her? What the social worker knew or didn't know? In that particular case, what the physician or the social worker or the nurse knew in another case can have no bearing on what Dr. K knew or the social worker or the nurse knew in this particular case. And as Justice O'Donnell pointed out in his concurring opinion in Yates, it will take a separate trial to understand what was in the mind of the reporter or the nurse or social worker or the patient in these other cases, which have no bearing on the decision in this case anyway. And by the way, I add that it was this allegation of systematic and intentional failure that the Court of Appeals, in a unanimous opinion, described as an artifice. And that's a strong word. I think the allegation is, at the very least, a big red herring, because none of the evidence from any other case will have any bearing on the disposition of any of her claims. Why?
Let me ask you about the Joe Dieter's position on the criminal aspects. I was interested in that when I accepted this case because of the allegation that failure to report was a criminal violation if there was a child abuse, and I was interested in that effect on the punitives. But as I understand in reading the briefs, there was never a criminal prosecution in this case, or Joe Dieter's office, the prosecutor's office, declined to pursue.
There was no prosecution, and the prosecutor's office investigated.
If they still choose to go forward, do they have a separate power of subpoena independent of this legal issue before us?
Yes. There is nothing about this case that restricts any prosecutor from proceeding. And in fact, the plaintiffs have all the evidence they need to try this case. They've got the chart. They've got policies and procedures. They've got protocols. They can take the deposition of Dr. Cade. They can take the deposition of the nurse or social worker. They can do all that to try whether there is a failure in this case that's actionable. And I want to say on the other claims, on the wrongful notice claim, the question here is whether the notice to the literal abuser after Jane Roe gave the incorrect telephone number, and in fact she tendered three falsehoods, but the question is whether that is defensible under this case. It's not comparable to another case. Under the parental failure of parental consent claim, the parental consent statute was enjoined at the time of this particular surgical event. With respect to the informed consent claim, the only question is what information was provided to Jane Roe in this particular case, what forms she signed. That's all available to counsel. There is no need, much less necessity, for any other record. I suggest to the court that the true interest all along has been in punitive damages. At page 82 of the trial transcript, counsel said to the trial court, "We need these for punitive damages." And if that's the true need, the obstacles are insurmountable. First of all, the Philip Morris case decided by the United States Court in last year, in 2007, holds that you can't base punitive damages on harm to third parties. And on the reprehensibility element, which Justice Lansinger, you wrote about in Barnes recently, the requirement is to show actual harm. These redacted records will not show actual harm to anybody.
Would they demonstrate
silent.
A pattern of conduct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Would they demonstrate a pattern of conduct?
They will not demonstrate a pattern of conduct. In fact, the if you take Jane Roe's records, for example, it will show that a notice was made to the father.
Well,
when you say notice was made to the father, and you can correct me if my memory's wrong, I know there's a suggestion.
I mean her biological father.
You're not referring to the telephone number that was given to Planned Parenthood or Dr. K that was, in fact,
the chart,
21-year-old boyfriend.
I'm not. The chart will show that notice was made to Jane Roe's biological father.
Our rules of discovery authorize records to be released if they're designed to lead to admissible. They don't have to be admissible. But if they're designed to lead to admissible evidence, then they can be discovered. Right?
Not if the matters are...
Don't even have to be relevant. Might lead to admissible evidence. That's our test.
If the records are privileged, they are not within the scope of discovery under Rule 26. And then, if the records are relevant, and I submit respectfully, that they can never be relevant here because they can't show a need after Crane Act.
We don't get to relevance, but to go back to your point on privilege, if we redact the information, isn't the real question for us to determine whether they are privileged at that point?
No.
And isn't there a split of authority in the country on that subject?
The fact of redaction doesn't change the nature of the privilege, Your Honor. They are still privileged. These are medical records. They were and always medical records. If they are redacted, they are still privileged.
And there's a split of authority with respect to the release of redacted records. You'd agree with that?
Would you say that again, please?
What's your case study on other courts that have considered release of redacted medical records? What does that show?
In Ohio, they are negligent credentialing claims where the records weren't necessary. They established the necessity under the Biddle test. First of all, this is the first time in the country that anyone has ever attempted to get these records in behalf of a single private plaintiff. And counsel admitted
this
that.
This is a first impression in the country, you're telling
first
me.
First impression, and in fact, in the trial court, plaintiff's counsel said he didn't know of any other case in the country where anyone is trying to get these records. There's no grand jury proceeding. It's not a criminal act. It's not a class action. This is a single private plaintiff.
The privilege is qualified, is it not, under this court's ruling in Biddle?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
Hasn't this court articulated a position that it's a qualified privilege?
No, I don't think so. I think what the court has said, they are privileged. To outweigh the privilege, there must be a showing of necessity. And if that, by definition, is a qualified privilege, then it is. But what Biddle holds is that it must be a special situation, which this isn't, because there's no statutory mandate. In fact, the statutory mandate is otherwise. These records are privileged, and they are confidential under 2151.421H. Or there must be a necessity. And necessity in Ohio jurisprudence has been the negligent credentialing case like the one the court just heard. But this case presents no necessity because these plaintiffs can try every single one of their claims without these records.
Counsel, I want to come back to your statement that the record that's blown up here would show that Jane Roe's father was notified. And your point is not that he was actually notified, but what the record would reflect. Am I correct?
I'm sorry.
Am I correct in that? You're not saying he was actually notified. The record reflects that he was notified.
I am saying about redacted records first that redaction never ensures privacy. And in fact, at page 86 of the transcript, when the trial court said, "Will I ever learn these names or will anybody else?" counsel said, "I can't answer that, Your Honor." Number one, redaction doesn't ensure privacy. But number two, these redacted records are probative of nothing. Those are the two points I make in connection with redacted records.
Well, I'm back to my question. You were not saying that her father was actually notified. You're saying that the record reflects that he was notified.
Yes.
All right. Now, with respect to the Court of Appeals, Judge Painter indicated that for the basic complaint here, the information that the plaintiffs already have is all that they need, even to get to the punitive, because punitive is specifically allowed. But on 2151.421, there's an argument about the appropriateness of that even being in the case, is there not?
The Court of Appeals essentially said there's no necessity, and it analyzed the legal elements of each claim to arrive at that conclusion. And it arrived at that with respect to the abuse reporting claim, with respect to the wrongful notice claim, with respect to the parental consent claim and the informed consent claim. What it said was you have to evaluate each claim. That's what the Court of Appeals ultimately concluded, that you don't need these records, you only need Jane Roe's record to show what's required to be proven on each one of those claims. I see my time is about up. In conclusion, I ask that the court uphold what the General Assembly established in 1870 when it established the physician-patient privilege. Uphold what the General Assembly established in 1975 when it first provided that abuse reports are confidential. Uphold what the court established first in Biddle in 1999 and confirmed this year in Hageman. I submit that what is so deeply troubling about this request is that the patients who are most adversely affected by this are not here before this court and are unrepresented and cannot direct the disclosure of their records, the first principle of this court's decision in Hageman. I submit respectively that the decision of this court should be as follows. Where the privileged medical records and abuse reports of unrepresented non-party minors are not necessary to prove the claims of a single private plaintiff, they are not subject to discovery. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Buckley. Mr. Miller, you've used your time, quite a bit of extra time, but I'll give you 30 seconds. Or Mr. Hurley? Sure.
Justice Piper, I'd like to respond to one of your questions, and that is whether or not this is about also interrogatories and requests for admissions. The answer is we believe not, because we believe it wasn't appealed. However, the defendants have refused to respond to those requests based upon that decision. So our position, Your Honor, is that we don't believe it is the subject of the appeal, but if you were to find that it is, we believe that we're entitled to that information, just the raw data in response to those requests.
Mr. Hurley, let me ask you, this doesn't go to the legal issue before us, but you know there are a number of amicus briefs filed, and two or three of them impress upon us the notion that if records like this are to be given in discovery, even though they're redacted, that that's going to deter young women from going to Planned Parenthood and other similar agencies, because they will worry about the fact that their records, who knows how much of their record is going to be revealed to third parties. What's your response to that?
I have 2 points, Your Honor. One is, as we've said throughout this, we believe that they should be redacted, so there's no possible way that anybody, a third party, can learn the identity. And Planned Parenthood has the first right to do the redaction. The second thing I would say is the competing interest is, Your Honor, certainly, even if there's a slight possibility of that, the competing interest is how many of these young girls If reporters are not required to show that they actually meet their obligation, how many of these young girls are going to be continued to be abused? There's no question there is a possibility, I suppose, some theoretical possibility, that some techno guru could find out the name of somebody. But they've never established how that could happen. But we would say that, Your Honor, the competing interest is such that...
Well, counsel, let me stop you there. You say find out how many are being abused. Abuse is statutorily defined, and it depends on the age of the young woman and the age of the sexual partner. Now, the second part of that equation, is there any requirement that the young woman who presents herself is required to reveal the age of the sexual partner?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. There's no requirement, and in fact, and this goes to our allegations of pattern of practice, on Planned Parenthood's own forms, they never even have they don't have a spot for the age of the alleged violator.
But there is no requirement on the part of the young woman to reveal that.
There is no, that's correct, Your Honor.
And no requirement of the parents of a young woman who presents to reveal that information.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So fundamental to abuse is the answer to a question that is not required to be propounded, and the answer of which is not required to be given. Doesn't that undermine the whole idea that going through all of these records will reveal abuse? Suspected abuse.
I don't think so, Your Honor. And this kind of relates to what Justice Cupps was asking about. What would these records show? The records that would establish when reports were made? We believe, Your Honor, what it will establish is that they only report when there's been a disclosure of rape or there's been a disclosure of the age disparity so that there's a requirement to report. So we think it's the absence of the records, Your Honor, that reflect the pattern and practice and the policy not to report suspected abuse.
But you've just said you already know there's not even a place on the form for this question. So your case, your statistical case, is based strictly on age of the young women who present.
Not just that, Your Honor.
And the data that you have from other sources that indicates that 50% of the sexual partners for women under a specific age are over a certain age.
I think that's in part true, Your Honor, but it's like any other case you present that's circumstantial. One piece of evidence may or may not be the piece of evidence that convinces a jury that in fact there was suspicion on the part of the person. This is just
if the question's not asked about the age of the sexual partner and the answer's not reported or recorded, does that place a burden on the child to extricate herself from a sexually abusive situation?
I'm not sure how to answer that, Your Honor, because in most of these situations, unfortunately, these young girls are not going to voluntarily disclose that they're being abused. So many of the situations, Your Honor, are family members or a family friend. So the truth is, if you're asking, do they have that duty? I don't know, but I would suspect that, and we would argue that these statutes are to protect these young girls who are in those situations, who in most situations are not going to disclose, not voluntarily say, I was raped, or I have a 25-year-old boyfriend. The statute says suspect or no. We believe the way Planned Parenthood reads this statute is in essence to read the duty to report suspected abuse right out of the statute.
So if they're not required to ask and the young woman is not required or her parents to report, then based on statistics, your argument essentially is Planned Parenthood needs to report suspected abuse for every young woman that presents.
No, Your Honor, we are not saying that. We're saying that if they're going to take the position, we follow the law all the time. and we can show statistically that, in fact, over, let's say this 5-year.
Well, then, are they required to interrogate?
No, they're not.
Regarding the sexual partner?
No, but they're not entitled to stick their head in the ground, Your Honor. And in
fact, if they're not required to interrogate, but you're saying based on the statistic that you have that indicates 50% of the time there will be abuse based on age, then there it's a Hobson's choice the way you present it. They either have to interrogate or they have to report.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what it shows, because we also have negligent training and policy claims here, it shows if, in fact, during this period of time, whatever they're doing never led to one report of suspected abuse, that their training and their policies aren't working. And that, in fact, during
Now you say one report of suspected abuse, and that glosses over the fact, I assume there are, in fact, reports of abuse that has been called to their attention, abuse that they learn of due either to the relationship, such as here, the coach, the age of the sexual partner.
Yes.
So they are reporting. You're not claiming they're not reporting when they actually learn.
No, no,
based on the age of the sexual partner, that there would be abuse.
We do believe, and their records reflect, that they do report when there is an affirmative disclosure that means they have to report. And we say that what that means is that they're meeting their duty, or apparently meeting their duty, to report known abuse. But we are saying that if during this 5-year period of time, there are no reports of suspected abuse, that's a clear indication that, in fact, they are not even attempting to meet their duty to report suspected abuse. That piece of evidence, Your
and
Honor,
how would one attempt to meet the duty then? That's where my question leads me. It seems to me you either have to interrogate,
or you
have to report everyone who is under a certain age.
You can ask questions, Your Honor.
Well,
that's
what I call interrogating.
Well, I guess I view interrogating as more harsh. I don't think that they have a duty to investigate, but they clearly...
Who got you pregnant? That's not interrogation. That's a question.
Yes.
So that's your view of their duty. They have to ask, who's the father?
And how old?
And how old?
And Your Honor...
In every case.
I believe with a minor, yes. I think.
And what part of the revised code requires that?
There's just nothing in the revised code, Your Honor. The question I think I was asked is, what does somebody need to look to make a determination of whether they should report suspected abuse? I would say, Your Honor, that probably the single biggest fact that would lead somebody to conclude that or to suspect there may be abuse is the age of the sex partner. They don't even ask that on their form. It's not even asked. And, Your Honor, again, I know we're at the discovery stage, so we don't have a record where we've proved our case. But there will be other testimony. I have tapes that, in which Planned Parenthood on the phone is saying, we don't ask that question. If you don't tell us, we don't have to report. We don't even ask the question of what your age is. We're not suggesting, Your Honor, that this information in and of itself wins our case. But especially with this court's decision in Kranach, where it's a subjective standard, they apparently believe they can get up and say, we didn't suspect, end of story. But in any case where there's a subjective standard, for example, in the old Section 1983 cases where abuse of force issues were at play, oftentimes police officer would say, listen, I thought I was going to be killed, or I thought that I needed to use this force, and it was my subjective standard, we win. And the court looked at it and said, no, plaintiffs have a right to put in circumstantial evidence to have a jury decide whether those claims are credible. May I address one point to Justice?
Let me ask you, will it be your contention as the case develops that if you had this information that you're seeking, that somehow would have prevented your client from having this problem? or that the agency would have done something different for, would have done something different for her because it would have suspected abuse, and then what?
Well, let me, I think for the a particular claim for her herself, as opposed to the whether our right to punitive damages
right.
and the amount of punitive damages. I'll set that aside for a second, Your Honor. Certainly, let's look at the facts of this case. 14-year-old girl comes in, 21-year-old guy, different last name, okay? They know at this point that they're not sure who they talked to on the phone. So we have that showing up. I would suspect, Your Honor, at that point, probably a poor use of use, we would argue at that point the lights should have gone on, not necessary to report it.
But that's your claim on the damages, just the damages against Planned Parenthood, isn't it?
No.
That they didn't act properly.
That's our both our liability part and the damage part. What we're saying, though, is, Your Honor, is when you tie the other evidence together, we now know what happened with her in particular. In addition to that, she came in, she's 14 years old. She's with a 21-year-old guy. Also, she has an STD. So with respect to the claim itself, we believe that that evidence is helps us prove the case. But with respect to the question of punitive damages, and this goes to one of the questions I think Justice Lassinger asked was, well, don't we have a right to punitive damages under two of the statutes? And the answer to that is correct, although we don't necessarily have a right to punitive damages under the abuse statute. So we need this evidence not only to attack the credibility of the what we believe is the self-serving denial, but to also, one, establish our right to punitive damages under the abuse statute.
Well, that's where we get the relevance issue. I know it's not here, but the fact that, let's assume that the agency did not report instances of abuse to the proper authorities, how does that get you punitive damages? I guess that's the problem I'm having with the theory of why you need the records.
Well, it gets to it, I think, Your Honor, is that in many cases, the best evidence to establish punitive damages is to show that whether it's a company, a governmental entity, they had a policy or practice to do certain things or not do certain things.
Okay.
And I guess, you know, if I may finish, Your Honor, to address what Mr. Buckley said about harm, I would submit that if we're able to establish that there is a pattern and practice of not reporting suspected abuse, the necessary thing that follows is that these young girls who otherwise would be protected aren't protected. So I think this court could take judicial notice of the fact that if, in fact, a report was not made when it should have been made, that there was harm. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is finally submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.